Chapter 26. To hide the painful perception of a humiliating position under the mask of indifference. Altogether, her conduct had shown her to be what in fact she was, a weak, though a calculating woman, one clever to conceive, weak to execute. One whose best laid schemes were forever liable to be frustrated by the ineradicable blight of vacillation at the critical hour of action. Oh, if I had only known that all this was going to happen. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she murmured again, as they paced along upon the rustling leaves. What did you say, ma'am? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the porter. Oh, nothing particular. We are getting near the old manor house by this time, I imagine. Apostrophe, apostrophe, very near now, ma'am. Apostrophe, apostrophe, they soon reached Manston's residence, round which the wind blew mournfully and chill. Passing under the detached gateway, they entered the porch. The porter stepped forward, knocked heavily and waited. Nobody came. Mrs. Manston then advanced to the door, and gave a different series of rappings less forcible, but more sustained. There was not a movement of any kind inside, not a ray of light visible. Nothing but the echo of her own knocks through the passages, and the dry scratching of the withered leaves blown about her feet upon the floor of the porch. The steward, of course, was not at home. Mrs. Cricket, not expecting that anybody would arrive till the time of the later train, had set the place in order, laid the supper table, and then locked the door, to go into the village and converse with her friends. Is there an inn in the village? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mrs. Manston, after the fourth and loudest rapping upon the iron-studded old door had resulted only in the fourth and loudest echo from the passages inside. Yes, ma'am. Apostrophe, apostrophe, who keeps it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Farmer Springrove. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I will go there tonight, apostrophe, she said decisively. It is too cold, and altogether too bad, for a woman to wait in the open road on anybody's account, gentle or simple. Apostrophe, apostrophe, they went down the park, and through the gate, into the village of Carriford. By the time they reached the Three Tranters, it was verging upon 10 o'clock. There, on the spot where 2 months earlier in the season the sunny and lively group of villagers making cider under the trees had greeted Cytherea's eyes, was nothing now intelligible but a vast cloak of darkness, from which came the low sough of the elms and the occasional creak of the swinging sign. They went to the door, Mrs. Manston shivering, but less from the cold than from the dreariness of her emotions. Neglect is the coldest of winter winds. It so happened that Edward Springrove was expected to arrive from London either on that evening or the next, and at the sound of voices his father came to the door fully expecting to see him. A picture of disappointment seldom witnessed in a man's face was visible in old Mr. Springrove's when he saw that the comer was a stranger. Mrs. Manston asked for a room, and one that had been prepared for Edward was immediately named as being ready for her, another being adaptable for Edward, should he come in. Without taking any refreshment, or entering any room downstairs, or even lifting her veil, she walked straight along the passage, and up to her apartment, the chambermaid preceding her. If Mr. Manston comes tonight, apostrophe she said, sitting on the bed as she had come in, and addressing the woman, tell him I cannot see him. Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes, ma'am. Apostrophe, apostrophe, the woman left the room, and Mrs. Manston locked the door. Before the servant had gone down more than 2 or 3 stairs, Mrs. Manston unfastened the door again, and held it ajar. Bring me some brandy, apostrophe, she said. The chambermaid went down to the bar, and brought up the spirit in a tumbler. When she came into the room, Mrs. Manston had not removed a single article of apparel, and was walking up and down, as if still quite undecided upon the course it was best to adopt. Outside the door, when it was closed upon her, the maid paused to listen for an instant. She heard Mrs. Manston talking to herself. This is welcome home. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she said. 2. From 10 to half past 11 p.m., a strange concurrence of phenomena now confronts us. During the autumn in which the past scenes were enacted, Mr. Springrove had plowed, harrowed, and cleaned a narrow and shaded piece of ground, lying at the back of his house, which for many years had been looked upon as irreclaimable waste. The couch grass extracted from the soil had been left to wither in the sun. Afterwards it was raked together, lighted in the customary way, and now lay smoldering in a large heap in the middle of the plot. It had been kindled 3 days previous to Mrs. Manston's arrival, and one or two villagers, of a more cautious and less sanguine temperament than Springrove, had suggested that the fire was almost too near the back of the house for its continuance to be unattended with risk, for though no danger could be apprehended, whilst the air remained moderately still, a brisk breeze blowing towards the house might possibly carry a spark across. "Eh, that's true enough," apostrophe said Springrove. "I must look round before going to bed and see that everything's safe. But to tell the truth, I am anxious to get the rubbish burned up before the rain comes to wash it into ground again. As to carrying the couch into the backfield to burn and bringing it back again, why, 'tis more than the ashes would be worth." ... "Well, that's very true," said the neighbors, and passed on. Two or three times during the first evening after the heap was lit, he went to the back door to take a survey. Before bolting and barring up for the night, he made a final and more careful examination. The slowly smoking pile showed not the slightest signs of activity. Springrove's perfectly sound conclusion was that as long as the heap was not stirred, and the wind continued in the quarter it blew from then, the couch would not flame, and that there could be no shadow of danger to anything, even a combustible substance, though it were no more than a yard off. The next morning the burning couch was discovered in precisely the same state as when he had gone to bed the preceding night. The heap smoked in the same manner the whole of that day. At bedtime the farmer looked towards it, but less carefully than on the first night. The morning and the whole of the third day still saw the heap in its old smoldering condition. Indeed, the smoke was less, and there seemed a probability that it might have to be rekindled on the morrow. After admitting Mrs. Manston to his house in the evening, and hearing her retire, Mr. Springrove returned to the front door, to listen for a sound of his son, and inquired concerning him of the railway porter, who sat for a while in the kitchen. The porter had not noticed young Mr. Springrove get out of the train, at which intelligence the old man concluded that he would probably not see his son till the next day, as Edward had hitherto made a point of coming by the train which had brought Mrs. Manston. Half an hour later the porter left the inn, Springrove at the same time going to the door to listen again an instant. Then he walked round and in at the back of the house. The farmer glanced at the heap casually and indifferently in passing. Two nights of safety seemed to ensure the third, and he was about to bolt and bar as usual, when the idea struck him that there was just a possibility of his son's return by the latest train, unlikely as it was that he would be so delayed. The old man thereupon left the door unfastened, looked to his usual matters indoors, and went to bed, it being then half past 10 o'clock. Farmers and horticulturists well know that it is in the nature of a heap of couch grass, when kindled in calm weather, to smolder for many days, and even weeks, until the whole mass is reduced to a powdery charcoal ash, displaying the while scarcely a sign of combustion beyond the volcano-like smoke from its summit. But the continuance of this quiet process is throughout its length at the mercy of one particular whim of nature. That is, a sudden breeze, by which the heap is liable to be fanned into a flame so brisk as to consume the whole in an hour or two. Had the farmer narrowly watched the pile when he went to close the door, he would have seen, besides the familiar twine of smoke from its summit, a quivering of the air around the mass, showing that a considerable heat had arisen inside. As the railway porter turned the corner of the row of houses adjoining the three tranters, a brisk new wind greeted his face and spread past him into the village. He walked along the high road till he came to a gate about 300 yards from the inn. Over the gate could be discerned the situation of the building he had just quitted. He carelessly turned his head in passing and saw behind him a clear red glow indicating the position of the couch heap. A glow without a flame, increasing and diminishing in brightness as the breeze quickened or fell, like the coal of a newly lighted cigar. If those cottages had been his, he thought, he should not care to have a fire so near them as that and the wind rising. But the cottages not being his, he went on his way to the station, where he was about to resume duty for the night. The road was now quite deserted. Till 4 o'clock the next morning, when the carters would go by to the stables, there was little probability of any human being passing the three tranters in. By 11, everybody in the house was asleep. It truly seemed as if the treacherous element knew there had arisen a grand opportunity for devastation. At 11:15, a slight stealthy crackle made itself heard amid the increasing moans of the night wind. The heap glowed brighter still, and burst into a flame. The flame sank, another breeze entered it, sustained it, and it grew to be first continuous and weak, then continuous and strong. At 11:20, a blast of wind carried an airy bit of ignited fern several yards forward, in a direction parallel to the houses and inn, and there deposited it on the ground. 5 minutes later another puff of wind carried a similar piece to a distance of 25 yards, where it also was dropped softly on the ground. Still the wind did not blow in the direction of the houses, and even now to a casual observer they would have appeared safe. But nature does few things directly. 1 minute later yet, an ignited fragment fell upon the straw covering of a long thatched heap or grave of mangel wurzel, lying in a direction at right angles to the house, and down toward the hedge. There the fragment faded to darkness. A short time subsequent to this, after many intermediate deposits and seemingly baffled attempts, another fragment fell on the mangel wurzel grave, and continued to glow. The glow was increased by the wind. The straw caught fire and burst into flame. It was inevitable that the flame should run along the ridge of the thatch towards a piggery at the end. Yet had the piggery been tiled, the time-honored hostel would even now at this last moment have been safe. But it was constructed as piggeries are mostly constructed, of wood and thatch. The hurdles and straw roof of the frail erection became ignited in their turn, and abutting as the shed did on the back of the inn, flamed up to the eaves of the main roof in less than 30 seconds. 3. 11:30 p.m. A hazardous length of time elapsed before the inmates of the three tranters knew of their danger. When at length the discovery was made, the rush was a rush for bare life. A man's voice calling, then screams, then loud stamping and shouts were heard. Mr. Springrove ran out first. 2 minutes later appeared the hostler and chambermaid, who were man and wife. The inn, as has been stated, was a quaint old building, and as inflammable as a beehive. It overhung the base at the level of the first floor, and again overhung at the eaves, which were finished with heavy oak arch boards. Every atom in its substance, every feature in its construction, favored the fire. The forked flames, lurid and smoky, became nearly lost to view, bursting forth again with a bound and loud crackle, increased tenfold in power and brightness. The crackling grew sharper. Long quivering shadows began to be flung from the stately trees at the end of the house. The square outline of the church tower, on the other side of the way, which had hitherto been a dark mass against a sky comparatively light, now began to appear as a light object against a sky of darkness, and even the narrow surface of the flagstaff at the top could be seen in its dark surrounding, brought out from its obscurity by the rays from the dancing light. Shouts and other noises increased in loudness and frequency. The lapse of 10 minutes brought most of the inhabitants of that end of the village into the street, followed in a short time by the rector, Mr. Ronham. Casting a hasty glance up and down, he beckoned to one or two of the men, and vanished again. In a short time wheels were heard, and Mr. Ronham and the men reappeared, with the garden engine, the only one in the village, except that at Knapwater House. After some little trouble the hose was connected with a tank in the old stable yard, and the puny instrument began to play. Several seemed paralyzed at first, and stood transfixed, their rigid faces looking like red-hot iron in the glaring light. In the confusion a woman cried, "Ring the bells backwards!" And three or four of the old and superstitious entered the belfry, and jangled them indescribably. Some were only half-dressed, and, to add to the horror, among them was Clerk Cricket, running up and down with a face streaming with blood, ghastly and pitiful to see, his excitement being so great that he had not the slightest conception of how, when, or where he came by the wound. The crowd was now busy at work, and tried to save a little of the furniture of the inn. The only room they could enter was the parlor, from which they managed to bring out the bureau, a few chairs, some old silver candlesticks, and half a dozen light Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.